this afternoon, the prophets and social justice. This evening, the prophets and judgment or violence. And tomorrow, the prophets and the future. One of the more important developments in thinking about the prophets is to think of them in relational terms. This is the 50th anniversary of the publication of Abraham Heschel's book, The Prophets, 1962. And it's one of the more influential pieces of work on the prophets that with which we have to do, and it has had much influence on my own work. One of his points is that the prophet is no messenger of God. The prophet is no mouthpiece of God. The prophet is one who enters deeply into a relationship with God. And here comes his words, who feels the feelings of God. Who feels the feelings of God. This prophet is in a deep relationship with God, and it affects deeply how he thinks about the relationship between himself and God and the people and God. I'd like to ask you to think of a person, friend, spouse, child, whatever, with whom you have a good relationship. Picture that person. Close friend? What makes that relationship good? What makes that relationship good? What makes that relationship a genuine relationship? Now think about the relationship you have with God. What makes that relationship good? Is the goodness of that relationship with God at all comparable to the relationship you have with your close friend? Are these relationships different? If so, how? Are they similar? The key question, what makes them genuine? What makes them good? What makes those relationships real? It's not enough to say that you believe in God. What matters finally is the kind of God in whom you believe. All kinds of people believe in God. And the kind of God of whom you speak will shape your life and your practice, your profession, willy-nilly. Eberhard Jungel, in his book, God is the Mystery of the World, makes an important point. The more one understands God, the more mysterious God becomes. And the deeper one penetrates the mystery, the more interesting God becomes. In other words, the more you know about God, the more you know you don't know. And if so, it would follow that the less you know about God, the less of a mystery God is. God is not demystified by further understanding. Indeed, the greater the understanding, the greater the divine inexhaustibility becomes apparent, and the more interesting it becomes. Certainly, God outdistances all of our language about God, and our images and metaphors for God come up short. God's God, we're not. Make it that's clear. At the same time, for all that God has revealed to us supremely in Jesus Christ, I think we have only begun to plumb the depths of the Scripture regarding who this God is and the relationship that we have with this God. As I make my way out and about in the church, I am amazed at how the images of God out there tend toward extremes. On the one hand, I think this is so increasingly since 9/11, Katrina, other events. God is the uninvolved overseer, sitting on the front porch of heaven watching the world go by. As one layperson put it to me in interaction with this topic, she said, you know, God is an absentee landlord. Oh, why do you think that about God? And she said, you know how it is with absentee landlords. Your calls are seldom returned and nothing much gets done. And she was serious. It's an understanding of God that I think is more prevalent now than 10 years ago. On the other hand, you get another extreme. God is an absolute monarch, in total control of things, micromanaging the world. On the other hand, as a student of mine said, if God is in total control, then given how unruly we all are, wouldn't you have to score God a crashing management failure? I think the biblical material wants us to steer clear between these extremes of uninvolved overseer and absolute monarch, if you will. Or another way of thinking about this, God is Superman, God is Superwoman, who say, here is prayers of trouble, and faster than a speeding bullet is able to accomplish everything and anything. With such a God, no constraints, no restraints of any kind are in view, and the only issue falls back on the sincerity of the one who prays. Or on the other hand, God is sort of like the King or Queen of England. Not much power there, but a sympathetic presence and an ability now and again to sponsor some elegant liturgical occasions. I think these extremes are also common among us. Relatedness, relationships. Our relationship language is crucial for our understanding of God. What do you mean when you use the word relationship with God? Well, in this language, I grew up in a pietistic home. I was always asked about my relationship with Jesus or relationship with God. It was a regular rhythm in my life. Well-worn phrases among many a Christian. It's interesting that biblical studies, theological studies, are increasingly attending to issues of relationality. One might note the scholarly energies being given, say, to Trinitarian reflections, increased attention given to our highly interdependent world, evident in, say, environmental scholarship. Relational interests and emphases have been intensified by this increased recognition of the connectedness of our life together. Whether you're talking about the impact, just think of the impact that 9/11 had, the rippling effects of the environmental crisis, the economic crises, even the use of the internet, Facebook. Connected is the word for the day. Relational thinking is key here for understanding the prophets, and I think for understanding God. The language of connection is, I think, important part of the experience of so many among us. We live in increasingly a spider web of the world, and developments across the globe at many levels, both positive and negative, have sent that web a shaking. We're fast moving from 6 degrees of separation, wherein each of us is only 6 persons removed from knowing everyone in the world, to 5 degrees of separation. And the key question becomes, how should this reality of connectedness experienced by so many people inside and outside of our churches shape our thinking about the prophets and God. Is the God whom we confess attractive to this increasingly interdependent audience for whom relational categories are so integral to self-understanding and to life? If what we say about the connectedness of our world is anywhere near the mark, our understanding of God needs to be looked at more carefully. How well does our imaging of God connect with this interrelated world? Listen to Elizabeth Johnson in her book, She Who Is. Religions die when they lose the power to interpret convincingly the full range of present experience in the light of their idea of God. The truth about God is tested by the extent to which the idea of God currently available in the church takes account of accessible reality and integrates the complexity of present experience into itself. And this, she concludes with this sentence: if our idea of God does not keep pace with developing reality, the power of experience pulls people on, and the God dies, fading from memory. Unquote. Is your image of God dying? Is it fading from memory? Interrelatedness is true not only of the world of creatures, it's also true of God and God's own identity. And let me make three quick points here about God and relationality. One is the Old Testament understands that relationality is basic to the very nature of God. We can just move into Trinitarian reflections there and be on with it. But already in the Old Testament, first chapter of Genesis, let us make humankind. The Old Testament commonly speaks of a divine assembly or a divine council. Jeremiah 23, for example, have you stood in the council of the Lord to hear what he has to say? Have you engaged in that committee, if you will, that council, conversation? And these texts testified of the sociality of God, that God belongs to a divine community that's rich, that's complex, so that relationship is integral to the very identity of God, independent of God's relationship with the world. A second is that this relational God has established a genuine relationship with the creation, and more specifically with Israel. We could observe this relationship at several levels, but just to note, say, the level of metaphors used. The biblical metaphors used for God are highly relational. You can think husband, wife, parent, child, teacher, student. I mean, you can go on down the list. And even when non-human creatures are drawn into a metaphor, a relationship remains at the very center of things. So the Lord is my shepherd, shepherd-sheep metaphor. I'm a mother in Exodus 19, a mother eagle and her eaglets. I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself, God says at Sinai. Even a metaphor such as rock gets interpreted relationally. And now we've got God as a very biblical image that should receive more attention from us these days. Both Old Testament and New Testament, God is a friend. In this Facebook day, it's a striking metaphor that we need to look more closely at. And then you would think of Jesus' language, John 15, 15. I don't call you servants any longer. I have called you friends. Friends. Now, what's characteristic of these metaphors is that they're relational and they're ordinary, common, everyday, earthly. Indeed, all this language for God is deeply secular. Rather than, say, heavenly language or religious language or even theological language. And these kinds of everyday relational images were believed to be most revealing of a God who enters deeply into the life of the world and is related to every creature who is not God. The Bible's filled with neglected metaphors for God. Take a look at your own preaching, teaching, praying. How many metaphors for God do you use? There are over 50 in the prophets. I find just to be able to begin to explore those metaphors. One of the recent experience, I was working with preaching in southern Minnesota, and I went to Psalm 96, sing to the Lord a new song, for he has done marvelous things, and I tried to develop the image of God as a musician. God is one who gives us new songs to sing. And I went to the door to shake hands with people afterward, and I was stunned, actually. One after another, I play the trombone. I sing in the church choir. I'm a soprano soloist. The music, the image of musician touched base with their daily experience in wide ranges. So we need to use as many metaphors for God as we can to help portray the fullness that is God, to make lively connections with the scriptures with which we have to do. Third, this relational God has created a world in which all creatures are interrelated. Every created entity is in a symbiotic relationship with every other, and in such a way that they reverberate out and affect the whole, shaking this web with varying degrees of intensity. And human beings, of course, have the capacity to shake this web positively or negatively in ways more intense and pervasive than any other creature. Human and non-human orders are deeply interconnected. It's important to recognize that such an understanding of interrelatedness stands over against any notion of a static or mechanistic world. Remember that God did not create the world a finished product. God created a good world, not a perfect world. Those are key themes. This is a genuine relationship which develops over time. There's a degree of open-endedness in the created order which makes room for novelty, makes room for surprise, for randomness. So this world of being deeply interrelated that God has created makes our attempt to understand how God faithfully relates to its creatures more complex. Let's say this: God works faithfully in the interplay of law and, to use the language of Ecclesiastes 9:11, chance. Time and chance happen to them all. Have you got room in your understanding of God for chance? Now, all too often, this relationship with God of which we speak may not look very much like our other relationships. And the coming back to that opening imaging I've asked you to do, the upshot may be that people will experience such a disjunction between their everyday experience of relationship and the way in which God is portrayed that the word relationship, when used of God, becomes meaningless or incoherent. What if we took this word relationship seriously? What if we used relationship language as in terms of a relationship of integrity, presumably the only kind of relationship that God can have, I think that we all would agree, I trust, that we'd want to keep our theology and our practice coherent, and we wouldn't want our theology to undercut our practice. So I'm concerned about the practical adequacy of our talk about God in relationship. And I have several items which I've developed, and I'd like to sort of unpack them a little bit. And let's thinking about what does it mean to be in a genuine relationship for this God with whom we have to do. And I think that the prophetic material is particularly important as we seek to break this out. Let me give five. I'm going to list two more, so we get a total of seven. That's important to get number seven on. And then I'll develop those last two in subsequent presentations this evening and tomorrow. One, God so enters into relationships such that God is not the only one who has something important to say. Wouldn't you agree? Communication is key to a healthy relationship. And in the interests of a healthy relationship, the Old Testament often speaks of prayer between God and human beings. Still with me a little bit, sorry about that. Couldn't you call prayer God's gift for the sake of healthy communication within a relationship? I mean, what would this relationship be like if God was the only one who had something important to say? Sorry. We could take a number of such biblical texts into account. Maybe you remember 2 Kings 20, where Isaiah comes to King Hezekiah and says, "You're going to die, you're not going to recover." No ifs, ands, or buts. Hezekiah prays. And God tells Isaiah, "Go back and tell Hezekiah he is going to recover. And I'll add 15 years to his life." God so values what Hezekiah has to say that God changes a divine decision. In other words, these texts, I mean, think Exodus 32, God's going to wipe out the people because they worshiped the golden calf. And Moses prays, and God changes his mind. Prayer can affect what people have to say, can affect the divine decision. God so values what we bring to this relationship that it changes the decision-making situation even for God. Can you go there? If you're going to think genuinely about relationship, think seriously about going there. Second, God so enters into relationships that God will remain absolutely faithful to commitments made. And here, the prophets come into view especially with respect to all the promises that they make. Promises, promises, promises. Sometimes we entertain the notion that God is absolutely free, could do anything at any time, at any place, for any reason. I beg you, don't go there. To think of divine freedom in this way is to cast doubt on God's promises. When God makes a promise, God limits God's options. Walter Brueggemann and I disagree deeply here, and we've talked about this many times. He has in his saying, his commentary on Jeremiah, he says that in reference to the judgment talk that you find in Jeremiah, and we'll come to that this evening, some, is God, he says, God can withdraw fidelity, unquote, or God can, quote, cancel the commitment that God has made with Israel. Really? Is God free to break God's promises? If so, is God then no more faithful in relationships than human beings are? I think we at times teach our people that we so lift up God's freedom that we trump God's promises. To speak of God's promises, and the prophets, again, are filled with them, particularly with regard to, say, David, is to speak of a God who places a limitation on the exercise of divine freedom. I will not do that. I will do this. God will do what God says God will do. God will be faithful to God's own promises. To speak of the freedom of God in an unqualified way has ethical implications. And I think people will often be able to see right through it. If God is radically free, then we who are God's followers, living in the image of God, right, should seek to be radically free so we can sit loose to our commitments and get on with our unfettered lives. We'll follow God's example. Another way to think about God's faithfulness in relationship is to speak about God's promise of presence. And here we could go to Jeremiah 23. The whole world is full of God. The world is full of God. Wow. You can't go anywhere in this world without encountering the presence of God. Or you could go back into Joshua. The Lord is with you wherever you go. Now, sometimes we undercut that witness, I think, and we use the language of God's intervention. Well, I'd invite you to think about the use of that language of intervention. An inference, I think, that a lot of people, I find it among students, is that God is really not pervasively present, but now and again intervenes with a goodie or a baddie. At least that's how it's often heard. And so in times of suffering and grief, say somebody is not healed, and those involved conclude that God didn't intervene to help. Accompanying this way of understanding may be a loss of the sense of the presence of God in such times of trouble and death. But do you read the prophets carefully on this issue of presence? God is present at every event and active on every occasion. God is present in the big events. God is present in the little events. God is present in the spiritual moments as well as in that which is physical and bodily. God is present at our joyous occasions. I always love that end of Zephaniah, not much. God says, I will sing, I will rejoice over you with loud singing. I mean, the kind of presence of God in times of joy, but also in times of violence. Even in the most Hitlerian of situations, and Israel often faced them, just read the book of Lamentations sometime, God is understood to be present. That's a grand witness to God, and we should be alert not to undercut it in one way or another. But of course it raises questions. Where was God? Well, God was there. Well, what are you going to do with that? raises issues of divine power, to which we'll return later. This evening, I guess. Third, God so enters into relationships that God is genuinely affected by what happens to the relationship. To use a big word, the point has to do with the affectability of God. The affectability of God. What kind of relationship would this be if God were never affected by what happens to the relationship? And prophetic texts regarding divine affectivity or affectability abound. I mean, the Bible begins opening of the flood story with God not... There's no word about God's anger associated with the flood. The opening word about God is that God has got tears running down his face. Grief, everyday word for grief. And go to Jeremiah, who sometimes called the weeping prophet, and the weeping in Jeremiah is not simply the weeping of the prophet. It's the weeping of God, and the weeping of the prophet embodies the weeping of God. And so, Jeremiah 9, for example, I will take up weeping, God speaking, I will take up weeping and wailing for the mountains and a lamentation for the pastures of the wilderness, because they are laid waste so that no one passes through. And the lowing of cattle is not heard, and the birds of the air and the animals have fled and are gone. What's happened to the non-human world occasions weeping for God. Or listen to Jeremiah 9:17. Thus says the Lord of hosts, consider, call for the mourning women to come, those who represent the community in times of death in the community, gather around the family. Call for the mourning women to come. Send for the skilled women to come. Let them quickly raise a dirge over us, so that our eyes, who's speaking here? The Lord of hosts. So our, got to include God, our eyes may run down with tears, and our eyelids flow with water. For a sound of wailing is heard from Zion. How we are ruined, we are utterly shamed because we've left the land and they have cast down our dwellings. That God deeply affected by what happens to people and indeed to the environment. This God who is in relationship is in genuine relationship and is affected by what happens. We could say that God is both constant and changing. God will, on the one hand, be faithful to promises made. You don't have to worry about that, folks. God will always will the best for us. You don't need to worry about that. God's love will be there for you through thick and thin. Go with it. God's core character will never change. Yes. But at the same time, in order to remain true to that character and those commitments, God must change in view of new times and places through which the people are moving. And so you have these remarkable prophetic texts where, say, in the book of Jeremiah, particularly look at Jeremiah 18 as an example. You could go to Jeremiah 26. You could go to Jonah 3. There's over 40 references to God as the subject of the verb to change one's mind. 40. And in Jeremiah 18, you get this language, verse 5. Let me just pick up a couple of, let's see. Verse 7, at one moment I may declare concerning a nation or a kingdom that I will pluck up and break down and destroy it. But if that nation concerning which I have spoken turns from its evil, I'll change my mind about the disaster that I intended to bring on it. And so forth. There's the that kind of recognition that it's not that God is convinced by Mosaic logic or that God had not thought of this option before. But God values the relationship, so that God, in view of that relationship, takes a different path into the future. God takes the response of the other in relationship with genuine seriousness. Fourth, God so enters into relationships that the human will can stand over against the will of God. As I get out and about in the church, I've been surprised, even alarmed, at the extent to which the will of God comes into the conversation, perhaps especially in thinking about issues such as evil and suffering. It seems that people often believe that the will of God is irresistible. And whatever God wills, God gets done. What kind of relationship is that? Creates all sorts of dissonance, I think, recognized or not. If God's will always gets done in the world, then let's see. Let's think of the breaking of the commandments. The commandments are an expression of the will of God, right? And people break the commandments. Isn't that a successful resistance of the will of God? If God's will always gets done, why the over 500 references to God's anger in the Bible? Most often in the prophets. What's God angry at if God's will is not successfully resisted? Is God angry at himself? Human beings can resist the will of God. God gets angry because of that. Common prophetic theme. Remember Jesus' words over Jerusalem? How often would I have gathered you as a hen gathers her brood under her wings? But you were not willing. You were not willing. Fifth and last today, or this hour, God so enters into relationships that God is concerned about our entire selves, not only our spiritual lives, but our bodily lives as well. This concern of God for our whole self is an important dimension of what the prophets have to say, particularly about God's saving work in the world. The prophetic understanding of salvation has often been narrowly conceived in the life of the church. I think salvation is probably most associated with the forgiveness of sin, but that's my Lutheran direction coming here, maybe not here. But at times, it is just limited to that spiritual dimension. And it neglects a great deal of biblical material about salvation. In such a restricted understanding, that God's most fundamental activity in the world then has to do with sin and guilt. Only secondarily is God, say, concerned about suffering and shame. But the Bible wants to claim, thinking prophetic material in particular, that God's saving work in the world has to do not simply with deliverance from one's sin, but also deliverance from the effects of sin, both the effects of one's own sin and the effects of the sins of others. Think of the two major pillars around which the Old Testament is gathered, the Exodus from Egypt and the exile to Babylon, and the deliverance bringing them home from Babylon. In the first instance, Israel's suffering occurs because of the sins of others, the Egyptians. In the second, Israel's suffering occurs because of their own sin. It's interesting. In the Exodus material, God didn't tell Moses, now you go down and you tell Israelites that their sins are forgiven. There's nothing about forgiveness in Exodus 1 to 15. God says to Moses, get them out of there. And Exodus 15 says, names it salvation. Salvation here does not have simply to do with the spiritual. Or if you go to the exile material, the material, say, in Isaiah 40 to 55, there's a clear announcement of comfort, comfort ye my people, the Lord has forgiven you double for all your sins. But that's not the end of the salvation activity of God in that book. The salvation of God continues bring them home. And salvation then becomes complete in that move of God to bring them home. This broad understanding of salvation is present throughout the prophets. And what about our preaching and teaching to those around us? If we suggest that forgiveness is really the only thing that God is finally concerned about, then maybe other dimensions of our talk about God will take on a second-class character. But it's the work of God in the Old Testament, and I would also call in Jesus' ministry here as a God, where he names here as a help to the suffering ones. Healing is named in the language of salvation. But we ought to, if the work of God is so described, we ought to have a comparable concern about the effects of sin, of our own sin, of the sins of others, and all the suffering that that has brought our way. And we get into some of these issues later today. Listen to Patrick Miller. I think this is a nice piece. It can bring it home. Jesus Christ lived and died not only to save you from your sin, but also to heal your hurt. To heal your hurt. And in this connection, we should remember the biblical testimony to salvation in the life to come. We confess belief in the resurrection of the body. God's not simply concerned about the body in the next life. And the prophets, again and again, how earthy they are in their talking about God's future work of salvation. Just read the end of Isaiah 65. They'll build homes and inhabit them. The crops will be so abundant that they'll pile up on one another. So in Isaiah 25, where you get this double reference to in that new day, you're going to be served the best wine possible. In other words, this is a full-bodied salvation of which they're speaking. But God doesn't become concerned about the body only after death. God's saving work in the world has to do with everything that's you. Everything that's you, not only in the new world, but now as well. That's a genuine relational understanding of God's engagement with us. Now let me just name the sixth and the seventh, and I'll close. The sixth, God so enters into relationships that God is not the only one who has something important to do and the power with which to do it. And we'll get into that more this evening. And seventh, God so enters into relationships that God doesn't have the entire future mapped out. That something that you and I do can actually affect the shape of the future. And we'll talk about that tomorrow morning. I would hope you'd at least take a closer look at these understandings of relationship. This relational God, in all of the divine complexity, is remarkably interesting. And preaching and teaching about this kind of God can be remarkably interesting too. So at least one thing you'll say when you get to heaven and God starts talking is, you know, that's really interesting. Thank you very much.